Good morning. My name is Pat Hayden, and this is a session on the World Council of Churches Assembly, a foretaste of the feast to come. Let me just begin by saying a little bit about what the World Council of Churches is. Perhaps you all know, but it'll just be good background for all of us. It's, in this year, a family of 300 churches from the Protestant and the Orthodox traditions, from over 100 countries, representing altogether about 450 million Christians around the world. It was begun in 1948 with about 100 churches, and it has grown twofold since that time. The churches that were officially represented at the World Council of Churches Assembly in Vancouver this last August were the Reformed Churches, Lutheran Churches, Eastern Orthodox, Anglican, Methodist, United Churches, Oriental Orthodox, Baptist, Moravian, Disciples, Old Catholics, Independents, Pentecostals, Kimbanguist, Martoma, Mennonite, Brethren, and others. Wow. So that gives you some idea of the enormous diversity that is included in the World Council of Churches. It is a family of churches. It is not like the Vatican. The relationship of the Roman Catholic Church to the World Council of Churches is one of partnership and very close collaboration, although the Roman Catholic Church is not, and in the foreseeable future will not become, a member of the World Council of Churches. What is a WCC assembly? I'll use the alphabet now. An assembly is a gathering every 7 or 8 years in the life of the World Council for elected delegates from all the churches to come together to consider the concerns of this family, both the points of union and the points of division among them. And it's a very biblical concept, Council of Churches. The first one is recorded in our book of Acts with the council in Jerusalem that did exactly the same thing, to deal with both some points of commonality and resolve some problems. The sixth assembly was the one held at Vancouver, British Columbia, on the campus of the University of British Columbia for 18 days this last summer. It began on the 24th of July and ended on the 10th of August. There were between 3,500 and 5,000 people there during those 18 days. And I have some pictures, which I'll pass around and let you look at, just a very few pictures, that maybe will give you a little bit of a sense of that while I go on and talk about some of the specifics in the assembly. Some of these pictures are black and white photographs that I took. Most of my pictures are in slides, and I haven't been able to get them sorted yet. The others are pictures of the campus and of the postcards that the World Council had printed of some of the main events. So take a look at those and pass them around among you. Of those people, there were 1,000 elected delegates from all of the churches that I mentioned, 1,000 advisors, staff, and volunteers who worked with the assembly, 1,000 visitors, and about 1,000 members of the press from all over the world. I was in the one of the 1,000 visitor category in a special category called accredited visitors. There were 750 of us from all over the world, 200 from Canada, 300 from the U.S., and the balance from the rest of the world. These were people who applied to attend the whole assembly as an official visitor who had to pay their own way, both the registration and their room and board, but then who had access to all of the public sessions of the assembly, the plenary sessions, the worship events, and a special visitors program, which was arranged for us, which paralleled the sessions that the delegates were involved in. Many people said that this special visitor program was even more interesting and rich than the work the delegates had to do. And I know we had really quite a marvelous time. We had several different activities that we could be part of in the morning. They arranged sessions for us to meet important people who were there as a part of the assembly, to talk with representatives of churches from different parts of the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, the United States, Canada. The opportunity to talk with women and to hear women's voices of concerns throughout the world. Interfaith dialogues, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, Buddhist, to be concerned about peace and justice issues, and to talk with those who were involved in them, and to talk about the work of the World Council in its various departments and activities. We also had some other opportunities. We were invited, those of us who wanted to join an intergenerational Bible study, which for me was one of the highlights of the assembly. 40 people, 20 of them adults, and 20 of them children. The children ranged in age from 4 to 17, and the adults ranged in age from 18, or whatever the cutoff point was, to 85. And we met together 4 different times under the leadership of Hans-Rudi Weber, and together did Bible study under the theme, We Want to See Jesus. And this was really just a marvelous experience of being able to work both with words and with pictures, with drama and with music, to understand more the Bible and the way it can help us learn from one another. Another part of the assembly, which for me was very important, was the music. The incredible richness and diversity of Christian music around the world was one of the great surprises to me of the World Council of Churches Assembly, and something I will treasure all my life. It has really become a part of me. And I have a tape, which I'm willing to loan to anybody who is interested during these next several days, of musical highlights from the World Council of Churches Assembly. All of the music taken from this worship book, which was a book both of prayers and litanies and music that we used during our time together at the assembly. I just should say that as I was trying to prepare this session, I found it very difficult, because trying to relive 18 days of one of the highlights of your life with experiences which had you at the very top of joy and at the very bottom of pain and anguish is just very, very difficult to summarize in about 45 minutes. Well, it was a full, vigorous day's program. We began each morning at 8:15 with worship in the great tent which had been set up for all of us, a yellow and white circus tent, which was the site of worship for the whole duration of the assembly. This would last for about 30 minutes. And then at 9 o'clock, we began plenary sessions in the War Memorial Gymnasium, which was the large building that was big enough to accommodate all of us for our meetings. And very often, we would meet with one coffee break until noon. Then in the afternoon, we alternated between again coming all back together again or having smaller group meetings when we began to work on the issues. The issues which needed statements and discussions and reflection among all the people who were there. Then we broke into small groups. At noon, there were always preaching services in the tent of worship. And then in the evening, after dinner, there was a closing, an evening worship service. But the activity of the Council of Churches went on in all kinds of small groups, discussion sessions that were not only for visitors and delegates, but a whole raft of public program things. We had speeches and presentations and musical events, multicultural activities. It was just the richest variety of things that you can imagine there. It was not unlike the experience that you have coming to Holden Village, where you come as strangers and you come into a climate where you know that everyone is a Christian, and here you are housed and you are fed, but you are fed more than just with food. You are fed with conversations with people, with sessions, with struggles, with learning, with growing, with natural beauty that is around you, and with worship. I mean, it's no accident that Holden's life is grounded in its Vespers every night and in the Eucharist on Sunday. And it was no accident that the World Council of Churches Assembly began with a worship service and ended with a worship service, and that all of the struggles and the divisions and the difficulties which we wrestled with during those 18 days were gathered up each day into the worship that we shared in common. And I think for not only myself personally, but for many, many other people at the Assembly, the worship experience was really the highlight, one of the highlights of that Assembly. Now, what does that say, to say worship experience? In the morning, if you can imagine, 3,500 people coming together. Very simple morning prayer celebration. We would begin with songs, but we might sing them in English, German, Spanish, French, Greek, Russian, Indonesian, Brazilian, I mean Portuguese, not Brazilian. All the languages that you can, that are there are in the world in which to praise God, we used in our worship service. Then there would be prayers and scripture readings and a brief meditation and more music. And all of these things were done not just in English, but in all of these other languages. The official languages of the World Council of Churches are English, Spanish, French, German, and Russian, to which was added Greek. But in the course of the worship services, 30 or more languages were used from people all around the world. They also estimated that during the 18 days we were together, more than 900 people participated in leading those worship services, which gives you some idea of the richness and the diversity that was there. Men and women and children and clergy people and lay people, people with handicaps, those who were blind and deaf and in wheelchairs, everyone was included, both in the World Council of Churches Assembly and in the worship experience, not only as participant, but as leader. And I think that was part of the reason that it was such a rich experience, was because it really was an inclusive experience. No one was left out of this experience of worship. Each day, the part of the morning prayer would be to pray the Lord's Prayer. And each person was invited to pray that prayer in his or her own tongue. Now, that might sound initially like Babel, you know, like a recreation of the Tower of Babel, if you have 3,500 people praying in what? 200 or 300 different languages? But what we experienced, those of us who were there, was that wonderful cadence. When you say the Lord's Prayer, you know how it rises and falls. And if you listen to a group saying it in English like we did last night in the Eucharist, how you know what the next verse is. That same cadence exists in every language. And so even though the words sounded like Babel, you knew it was the Lord's Prayer because of this wonderful rising and falling of voices and sounds. And as one woman said, it was genuinely like having an experience of speaking in tongues. Instead of the worship being a divisive experience because of all this diversity, it was a very rich and unifying experience because we really felt the praise of God expressed in so many different ways. And I think for me, I know that becomes just a central understanding of worship, just something that now is so much a part of me that it is this broad, not this broad, that it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. But what was it that we gathered up in our worship? We gathered up all of the struggle and distress that exists in our world today. And I guess if I had anything that I came away from the assembly with as a key point, was a new way of looking at the criticism we hear so often in the United States, that the World Council of Churches is only concerned about political, economic, social, racial justice issues, that it's concentrated on those and forgets the business of being the church of the Lord Jesus Christ. What was a revelation to me was that the World Council of Churches is involved in these activities, issues of peace and justice and poverty and racism, sexism, precisely because 450 million Christians around the world are living out their lives in these circumstances. And the World Council of Churches becomes the arena in which that is reflected, in all of its brokenness, in all of its tension, in all of its diversity. So that there was always this rhythm during the 18 days between celebrating and confessing Jesus Christ, the life of the world, which was our theme, and struggling with what that confession means as we live out our lives as Christian men and women, wherever we find ourselves in the world. Most of the really moving moments in the assembly came when people told their own stories of how that involvement was lived out. Part of my struggle was to try to even begin to select some of those stories that I heard, because there were so many and they came from such varied circumstances. Let me try to share just a few with you. As you might imagine, probably the key issue with which the assembly wrestled, besides church union, which I do want to talk about in a little bit, was the issue of peace and justice. The issue of nuclear weapons, the arms race, the militarism, the cost in human lives. And we hear so much about that, but what does it really mean in very personal terms? One of the presentations was from a young woman from the Marshall Islands in the Pacific. She's in her early 20s. I would say maybe she's 22 or 23 years old. She grew up downwind from the nuclear tests that were held in the Pacific in the 50s. Her family was moved from one of the islands that was cleared for those nuclear tests to another island. And she came and told us her own personal life story about growing up in this environment. And it's a very dramatic story, very difficult story for me as an American citizen to listen to. More than 66 atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs were exploded in Bikini and the Iwantak atolls in the Marshall Islands. Hundreds of Marshallese and American servicemen were contaminated by the results of these blasts, and there is an endless list of health problems now in the Marshall Islands. Cancers of all kinds, cataracts, miscarriages, and stillbirths. One of the biggest fears that women have and families is the possibility of what they call jellyfish babies being born. Babies who are born and who exist on the labor table for a few hours, they move up and down to show that they're breathing, but they look like a bag of jelly. They do not have the form and shape of human beings at all. Others are born with horns sticking out of their heads or with six toes and fingers. Darlene told us that she has four tumors in her body. One has been removed. And she doesn't know whether or not to have children because she doesn't know whether or not she will have a jellyfish baby. She talked about the way in which the U.S. government has been insensitive to the health problems of the Marshallese. And that is a scandalous story. And then she talked about the fact that today, one of the most beautiful lagoons, which has been used by the Marshallese for many, many years as a primary fishing lagoon, has been appropriated by the United States government to use as a site for a missile range from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And that just this last June, or the test began this last June. Before that, the people who were living around this lagoon were moved to a 66-acre reservation on another island where they joined 8,000 people who are enclosed in this asphalt and concrete jungle with very few facilities for anything approaching human life. In June, they began testing MX missiles in this lagoon, and they plan to continue with Minuteman and Trident missiles. Her plea was, we must stop this insanity before it gets to you. We are the victims of the nuclear age, she said. You can come and see us and talk to us and know what the effect of that, this uncontrolled nuclear arms race has been. It was a very, very powerful story. And she's a very diminutive little woman, maybe 5'1", 2", very slender. Doesn't look at all like her body is the effect of 20 years of living in a nuclear age, in a way that none of us, I think, can possibly know. Alan Bosak also spoke to the link between the issues of justice and peace, which was made again and again and again. Alan Bosak is considered one of the most promising young South African leaders. He is a black clergyman of the Dutch Reformed Church. He was elected this last August as head of the World Alliance of Reformed Churches, and he has been an outspoken opponent of apartheid, the official South African policy of separation of the races. And he spoke about the issues of racism in South Africa and the fact that it's possible that the Western countries like the United States will get so preoccupied with the arms race and with that issue of peace that they will forget that it is connected to the issue of justice, to racism, to poverty, to oppression, to the violation of human rights around the globe, and that we may be in danger of creating a new, what he calls, ideology of oppression if we focus only on peace and don't link it together with justice. This was made very graphic, not in a major plenary session, but in an evening banquet address that was held for many women, where various people spoke. And one of the persons who spoke was Helen Caldicott. You may know her, the physician who's been such a strong and outspoken opponent of the nuclear arms race. And she said, my children are going to live to be 92 years old, and no one is going to destroy them because of this nuclear arms race. An Indian woman who was on the panel with her said very quietly, none of our children live to be 92. They don't even have that possibility because of the lack of food and health and basic necessities of life. Those kinds of tensions and conflicts and realities were there during these 18 days. Another one, which was, I think, very important for me, was a statement by Dorothea Zola, who I don't know whether some of you know her. She is a woman, a German woman, and a theologian. She teaches half of the year in Germany at a theological institute and the other half of the year at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. And she was asked to address the issue of life in all its fullness, which was one of the sub-themes under the theme, Jesus Christ, the Life of the World. And she began her address by saying that she found it very difficult as a Christian to really address this issue of life in all its fullness when 2/3 of the world's population lives in a way that isn't even life, let alone life in all its fullness, with the poverty, with the death, the child mortality rate. But she went on, after talking about the poverty, to talk about the other threat to fullness of life that she sees in our world, which is the inward emptiness of the West. And I'd just like to read you a little bit of what she had to say about that. Life in all its fullness is an impossibility when one is forced to live in absolute poverty. But even in the wealthy first world, there is very little fulfilled life to be found, only an ever-growing inner emptiness. What comes between Christ and the middle classes of the first world is not material poverty, but spiritual emptiness. The meaninglessness of life perceived by many sensitive individuals ever since the beginning of industrial development has now become a widespread experience among the mass of people in the first world. Nothing delights them, nothing moves them deeply, their relationships are superficial and interchangeable, their hopes and dreams go no further than their next holiday trip. For the majority, work is unsatisfying, pointless, boring. God created us as men and women with a capacity for working and loving. We participate in creation in our work and in our sexuality in the widest sense of the word. Fullness of life means, among other things, becoming a worker and a lover. For most people in the first world, however, life is more like a long death lingering over many years. It is pain-free. There are pills and to spare, after all. It is feeling free. Don't be so emotional is an expression of strong disapproval in our language. It is without grace because life is seen as self-achieved and not as a gift from the Creator. It is life without a soul lived in a world which calculates everything in terms of what it's worth. Nothing is beautiful and a source of happiness for its own sake. The only thing that counts is what you can get for it. We are empty and at the same time surfeited with the superfluous goods and products. There is an odd relationship between the many objects we possess and consume and the emptiness of our real existence. While Christ came that we might have fullness of life, capitalism came to turn everything into money. That is the long death that looks out to us from so many empty faces. Just think for a moment of a traffic jam. Everyone sitting alone inside their own tin can, slowly and aggressively edging their way forward. Frustration and hatred of the people in front and the people behind is the normal reaction. This is an image of life in its emptiness in the rich world. And she sees this as great a threat to peace and justice as the poverty of the third world. These were difficult words to hear. There were lots of criticisms, as you might imagine, of the United States government and its policies. And I'd like to commend to you, as a way of understanding that, a letter that Bishop David Preuss has in the Lutheran Standard of September 16th, where he addresses that issue, I think, very clearly. And the reason why, if you heard about the World Council of Churches Assembly, there seemed to be so much criticism of the United States and so little of the Soviet Union. His basic point is that in the United States, we have the freedom to be critical. And people do not suffer personal persecution for speaking out against the government in the same way that those who come from the Soviet Union and many East Bloc countries.
We've also got standard of living now, I think.
Yes, yes, that's right. I could go on and on, but let me just try to share with you some of the other things very briefly, which were important to me, that you may not hear about if you listen both to the other tapes that are in the Holden Library, and I would commend them to you. There's a wonderful tape from John Taylor called The World Council of Churches Assembly Feast of Life. And there are also tapes from Gene Martinson and Dan Martinson, who were there, from Dan Erlander, who was there. And these, I think, would give you a little bit fuller picture than I am able to do today. One of the most exciting things that was a counterpoint to this struggle over peace and justice issues and human rights issues and participation of the whole human family in human community, and a lot of struggle between over the oppression of women as well as over third world poverty, which affects both men and women, was the primary focus of the World Council of Churches since its beginning, which is the unity of the churches. The family of churches that has been struggling to find an expression for those things that they share in common that are much greater than those things which divide them. And what the Assembly was able to celebrate in Vancouver in 1983 was something that was first celebrated in Lima, Peru in 1982. And these were two things. One was a theological statement on baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. And the other was the liturgical expression of this theological statement in what has come to be known as the Lima Liturgy. The theological statement is a broad consensus statement that forms the very beginnings of the discussion of those doctrinal points which for so many hundreds of years have separated Christian churches from one another. And what has been achieved in the last 10 years is a very healthy, strong conversation and dialogue among these churches, not engaging in what somebody called a polite ecumenism, but really wrestling with the issues and the statements that have for so many years kept us apart. And in this struggling have come out with a new statement to which all of these churches that I mentioned at the beginning can agree. Basic points of view about baptism, Eucharist, and ministry. And the process that the World Council of Churches is hoping all of us will engage in over the next 3 or 4 year period, all of us 450 million folks around the world, is to look at this statement, to discuss it in our own churches, to bring it before our church councils and assemblies, to see how much it states our understanding of these three things and our relationship with the other churches that share our communities. It's intended to be both a document which supports the ecumenical movement where it is and challenges it to move ahead another step. It's my hope that Holden might be one place where this document might be studied and talked about very fully. But that is for the theologians, which is us, on our working days, in our living days. And when it comes to Sunday, we celebrate the Feast of Life, which is the life of Jesus in the world, in the Eucharist, and in the liturgy of prayer and praise. And so on the 31st of July, 4,500 people crammed themselves into this yellow and white tent to celebrate this Lima liturgy together, a document which all of the churches who participate in the World Council had helped shape. And that, I think, as Dan Erlander said, I agree with, is probably the closest he will ever come to really feeling the presence of the kingdom of God on earth. As another Korean person said, an experience of being able to worship with the whole world family of Christians. It was a liturgy in which Archbishop Robert Runcie, the Archbishop of Canterbury, was the official celebrant, but he was assisted by, I can find my notes here, a woman pastor from the Lutheran Church in Denmark, a pastor from the Reformed Church in Indonesia, a Methodist from Benin, a Baptist from Hungary, a Moravian from Jamaica, and a pastor from the United Church in Canada. These were his assisting ministers as he consecrated the Eucharist and broke the bread and wine, which we all then shared from men and women together in partnership, holding the cup and the bread for us to commune, all 3,500 of us. To be sure, there were some people who could not and did not commune, primarily the Orthodox, because of their feelings about that, but they participated with us in the rest of the service. And what was important was that a Russian Orthodox bishop and a Roman Catholic bishop also were involved in the service with Archbishop Runcie, reading prayers, reading scripture. I mean, it was just a remarkable miracle of the family of God coming together in that unity for which Jesus prayed in the Gospel of John. And I think anyone who was a part of that experience, who saw it on television or any other way, can't help but have that be one of the high points of his or her life. For me, I'd like to share some personal experiences as a visitor. It was a time really for renewing a lot of old acquaintances, of friends that I had made during my 5 years of working with the Lutheran World Federation in its New York office. Some of the people I got to see were a woman who studied in the United States doing her theological degree at Dubuque in Iowa, who went back to Madagascar to begin women's work for the Lutheran Church in Madagascar. She is the only staff member for the whole Lutheran Church of Madagascar to try to begin women's work. So you have some idea of the task that she confronts now. A man from Brazil, a good friend that I worked with on a leadership document, who is struggling right now to find what is the proper place for him and his church in Brazil when he is teaching in a seminary which has tripled in the number of students attending it in the last 2 years, while the number of faculty has remained the same, to take up a radio ministry which reaches the whole country of Brazil through the Lutheran Church's radio stations, or to become involved in theological education by extension, which is a new way of providing theological education for lay folks like you and me around the world. When the Lutheran Church in Brazil sent out a letter to its parishes asking if people would be interested in a very short course in, I think it was, the life of Jesus, they had 17,000 responses.
Wow.
And they don't have... How do you respond to 17,000 requests for a short course, throughout the country, over many, many millions, thousands of miles? I had the chance to talk with a man who was my host in East Germany when I attended a conference there. He is a Lutheran pastor. In fact, he's more than that. He's what they call an Oberkirchenrat, which it took me a long time to say, which means that he's like a district bishop that we would call them now. And we sat down and talked together about what had happened in his country since I had been there. And then I told him about my year and my recent trip to Nicaragua. And that completely changed the conversation, and he wanted to know about Nicaragua. He wanted to know if what he read in their papers was true about Nicaragua. And so in this meeting of the two of us over a breakfast, we were able to bring the whole world together in a different way. My experience of Nicaragua and what I had learned, being able to tell him in East Germany, questioned how it was being presented in his papers, who wanted communication with Christian brothers and sisters in Nicaragua to know what was the reality with which they were struggling, just as he had the reality of the church in East Germany that he wished to share, not only with me, but through me with other people. I think that this was... You know, this is the strength, not only was at the assembly, but is the strength of the ecumenical movement, is Christian folks from very different places talking to one another about what is going on in their respective situations. All of us beginning with the commitment to Jesus as Lord of our lives, but seeking, as I said, to work out that commitment in the very concrete political, economic, social and cultural situations in which we find ourselves. The U.S. churches and the Central American churches gathered because they were together to talk about the controversy in Central America, which Dick will be bringing more to us this week in his sessions, and together made a covenant with each other to remain united, to establish a network of solidarity among people, regardless of the forces which will try to divide us from one another, and to set up those kinds of connections for information and for education so that we can continue to hear about what's going on in each other's countries, and together, through this covenant, make a commitment to work for peace. This covenant is to be shared with all of those who are members of the churches who were participating in the WCC assembly. I hope that we can talk a little bit more about that covenant, maybe in one of Dick's sessions. If not, that if you're interested, I have a copy and can make copies for you if you would like to take them back to your own churches. I talked with a friend also from Namibia, the country in southern Africa, which is still struggling so for its independence, and learned some more about that, the church and its work with a very war-torn, refugee-laden situation. One night, we had a peace and justice vigil because we had the occasion of the anniversary of Hiroshima. We gathered, again, about 3,500 of us to listen to speeches and songs, to participate with the children in releasing at least that many balloons as a statement of our commitment and hope for peace. We came back, and because it was a vigil all night long that ended with the Eucharistic celebration in the morning, we were in the tent with each part of the world, each of the churches represented from the world, taking a half an hour to present in prayer, in song, in solitude and meditation, their commitment to peace and the struggle for peace in their own land. At 1 o'clock in the morning, we heard from Desmond Tutu. Do you know of Desmond Tutu? He is an Anglican bishop from South Africa. He has been head of the South African Council of Churches. And one of the strongest opponents of apartheid, and also one of the strongest proponents for reconciliation between the races there. He had had his passport lifted by the South African government, even though he was an elected delegate to the assembly. They refused to let him travel to come. There was such protest around the world at this that, as John Taylor said, the South African government finally realized how foolish they were being, and they gave him his passport for the duration of the assembly. And it happened that he arrived on the night of this peace and justice vigil and came directly from the airport to the tent where we were all gathered to speak to us. And for many, many of us, Desmond Tutu is one of God's prophets in today's world because he speaks of the judgment that is coming because of racism, and he speaks of the reconciliation that is in the body and blood of Christ. The lack of bitterness, the lack of rancor and hatred in this man who himself has been subjected to so much of the reality of racism is really astonishing. But I'd just like to share with you, partly because it's very brief, his speech to us when he came. If you can imagine, he'd been flying all, 36 hours from South Africa. He had come directly from the airport. Here he was. And again, he's a diminutive little man, but charged with energy. We all greeted him, of course, when he came with sustained applause, is the way the paper puts it. But in fact, we were all standing on our feet, cheering and shouting when he came. And this is what he said. When one looks at the state of the world today, one says with relief, "Thank God I'm not God." When you stand in this place where so many of God's children are gathered together, you say, "Thank you, God, that you are God." It is one of the most wonderful things to belong to the Church of God. If you do not believe in the power of prayer, he continued, take it from me that the age of miracles has not ceased. Otherwise, why am I here? We in South Africa, who have had a few problems to handle, have been upheld wonderfully by your tremendous prayers. When the power of evil seems to be rampant, we have experienced God in your prayers like a wall of fire keeping away evil. God said, I want you to be my partner, to help me establish and extend my kingdom. When someone asks, why is that? The answer comes, that's God's partner, helping him establish the kingdom of shalom, justice, compassion, loving care, and sharing. And then he talked about a young black South African who works for the South African Council of Churches, who had spent 230 days in solitary confinement. Asked how he survived, he said, when I walked into the cell, I thought I was alone, and I was afraid. Suddenly, I discovered the presence of God, which seemed to say I was doing the right thing. After another 11 months in protective custody, his message to us, said Bishop Tutu, was, thank you for your prayers, and let's not be overcome by bitterness. That is someone claiming for God and his kingdom of justice and love. As we go out from here, let us make clear that kingdom. If God is for us, who can be against us? That's what he said. Desmond, he has lots of speeches, but I'm not sure that he has any books, specifically books out.
Like the Gandhi one has little paragraphs of his ideas, that might be good.
Alan Bosak has many books out, some of which I think are in the bookstore, which are really worth reading. I'll just like to close, although there's lots more I could say, with one new learning for me, which also came out of the World Council meeting. We met as visitors very close to the beginning of the assembly with Archbishop Ted Scott, who was the moderator of the Council of Churches from Canada, and Jose Miguel Bonino, who is a Methodist pastor from Argentina. Dr. Bonino is also head of an ecumenical seminary in Buenos Aires and a very well-known liberation theologian. Excuse me. One of the questions that was put to Archbishop Scott and Bonino was this question that we struggle with so often, is how do you keep together social action and praise of God? How do they live with each other? We are so used to thinking in our lives of the idea of transcendence, the dimension of vertical engagement, us and God, and then the horizontal dimension of engagement with our fellow human beings in issues of justice. And for us, these present a conflict. We have a problem trying to decide whether we're going this way or this way. And so Bonino and Scott were asked to address this. And what Dr. Bonino said, which really helped me understand this conflict from a new angle, a new dimension, was this. Not that you choose between one or the other, but that one lives inside the other. Each lives inside of the other, he said. That the presence of God is in events in history when people struggle to realize their full humanity. Prayer and adoration are an expression of trust in power and love of God, which will not let you go. And it's only as you risk your life do you realize the depth of the presence of God. Out of this realization come new songs and new prayers, which express this struggle of full humanity and realizing God's vision for the world. He says the problem is not how to keep them together, but how to make them visible that they live within each other. And for me, the World Council of Churches Assembly was an experience of that visibility in the presence of men and women sharing their stories. Although I remained a stranger to almost all of the 3,500 people, yet I was not a stranger and became a part of them in the worship that we shared together. Let me just open it up now for questions and have you ask about that. Whatever you'd like to know, I'll do my best to answer. Mary?
If the United States is part of the first world, and I know who's part of the third world, but who is a part of the second world?
The second world in the language is normally considered the Soviet Union and the East Bloc countries, those which are under the ideology of totalitarianism. Yeah. And I think Dorothea Zola's remarks could extend a lot to the second world too. You know, wherever you find this spiritual, this material wealth, even in the small elite in the third countries, you almost always find that spiritual emptiness that she really, I think, put her finger on quite well.
Dick? How many of the Eastern or the Orthodox churches were there, say, Russian
Orthodox? Oh, all of them, I think. There were Russian Orthodox and Romanian Orthodox and Egyptian, Coptic Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox. One of the things I heard was that the World Council of Churches has been an arena where the Orthodox churches, who are many, have been able to come together and begin to talking to one another too, that they have been very separated by their own both cultural traditions and ecclesiastical traditions. But there was a very large delegation from the Orthodox.
What is the feeling of the Orthodox churches about social justice issues?
Well, their feeling, I think, is that in their life it is expressed in the mystery of the liturgy and the Eucharist. They do not have the same sense of social engagement that most of the Protestant churches have. And it's become an occasion for dialogue between the Protestant churches and the Orthodox tradition, the one learning from the other, that we have sometimes in our Protestant churches tended to forget the power and the mystery of the Eucharist in the liturgical celebration. And this is something that the Orthodox bring to us. But it is true that they... one experiences them, I experience them at the World Council of Churches Assembly, as being engaged in a spirituality which is other, which is removed from this world. The single exception to that was a very moving presentation, which I have, you can read it, it's not the same in reading as it is in the hearing, of a woman who was an Orthodox laywoman who lives and works in Beirut, Lebanon. And she talked about the experience of last Easter in the midst of the conflict, of the war in Lebanon, and how you hold those two things together, how you live with the understanding that the resurrection is Christ crucified, and you are aware of all the pain and death around you. But you live with an expectation of hope. That was the closest that I heard of the two finding a way of really coming together where both of them were very solid. You'd have an Orthodox, and the Orthodox made many very good presentations in the plenaries, but they tended to be very abstract, very theological, very difficult to hang on to in your head. But her story was very easy to hang on to because it was caught up in the life of real people in a real situation. Does that help?
That helps. I would find it more hopeful if we saw more of that taking place in the Eastern Bloc countries. You mentioned the East German bishop and mm-hmm. had some concerns with that.
He's with the Lutheran Church.
Yes.
Yeah. Protestant churches in the East Bloc countries do tend to be much more socially conscious, although they pay a price for that as they struggle within their own societies for that. But they're very, very much alive and well. That's going to be one of the things that the Orthodox Church will struggle with. I mean, they are engaged and struggling. But I have to say, sometimes it did seem to me that they were kind of like the Missouri Synod of the World Council of Churches. They have an arrogance about their own spirituality, which is offensive, I think, to some of us. But we have had arrogance of another kind, which has been offensive to other people. And I think what is really so hopeful about the World Council of Churches is it is the one arena where people can come together as members of a family to struggle with those arrogances and try to find, you know, the things we can share together rather than the things which separate us and are causes for division.
5 or 6 years ago, we had an interesting sharing kind of a thing in the north end of Seattle. One Lutheran pastor and a Roman Catholic father, priest, and an Episcopalian one arranged, and they happened to meet in the Catholic church on a Sunday evening and shared together, and then they opened it to questions. And some of the people, like from the Catholic Church, they were asking how our church was organized, how did you get your officers, how do you make decisions, what do you believe on this? And it was just a wide open, real good feeling. These three men, after they all men who were pastors and priests, had been meeting together, and they shared the Eucharist together over some period of time. Very open kind of a thing.
That's what I hope can be continued by this Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry Statement. Because all of the churches who put that together are the first to say that's just a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a beginning. We still tend to think of ecumenism as cooperation between churches.
Yeah.
You know, the Protestant church cooperates with the Presbyterian church or the Methodist with the Roman Catholic. We really don't quite have a vision yet of what ecumenism is, which is the oneness of the body of Christ.
Do I understand correctly, this is secondhand, that there were political protests going on outside the area, and that the media made quite a bit of that, and I never did hear what they were protesting?
Well, there are, as you are very well aware, people who have who are very much against the World Council of Churches, and some of them were in attendance at Vancouver. Their numbers physically were very small, never more than, you know, 50 or 60 or at most 100 people. There were 100 people protesting outside the service on Sunday afternoon, the first afternoon we got together, when 15,000 people came together to participate in the service of welcome, which the Canadian churches organized for the World Council of Churches Assembly. And some of those had been paid. When people stopped to ask them why they were carrying banners which read WCC agent of KGB, which is the Russian secret police, they said somebody just paid us $5 an hour to carry these signs. But the real problem is that the media, both in Canada and the United States, made so much of that. I mean, they really unbalanced the situation. They did not speak about what I just shared with you, what the experience of those 3,500 to 5,000 Christian men and women was during those 3 weeks. They isolated one little segment of it. The people were free to protest. They stood in front of the plenary hall and handed us all literature as we walked in, and we took it. There were good conversations between people who were at the WCC and these protesters. they were free to come and go as they wanted to. This was an experience for some of the delegates from the Third World and the Second World, that this could go on too.
Who were these people protesting?
Well, they were, I don't know quite how it's fair to characterize them. They were some who were followers of Carl McIntyre in the United States and the Moral Majority, who are very threatened by a sense of enlarging our world, to and very protective, see, of what we have. Other people are from were from parts of the Christian tradition which are very conservative theologically, and to see that the church ought not to be engaged with any issue other than that of the salvation of souls. Again, the primary characteristic of them seems to be fear, exclusion of various kinds of reality from the way they live. That's a little description. One other thing I'll just share with you, because it was a wonderful picture. I mentioned the children who were involved in our intergenerational Bible study. During the time of the World Council, there was an ecumenical children's camp, which involved children from the United States and Canada, as well as some who had come from other countries. Canada, at least in the Vancouver area, is very multicultural and multiracial. Many Asian children, many Spanish, black children. So it was a very rich ecumenical experience for the children there. They led a worship service one morning for us, and participated with us in all of the major Eucharistic festivals that we had, as well as the other morning worship services where they also read lessons and prayers and such. But this was a small number of the children who were involved in the assembly. They had sent out a call a couple of years ago for children to write poems, make up stories, draw pictures of what the theme, Jesus Christ, the life of the world, meant for them. And they were invited to send these into Geneva. And I think maybe 6,000 or 7,000 children did this from around the world. And all of these pictures were put up in an exhibit around the plenary hall where all the delegates sat. The walls were surrounded by all these pictures from the children, and the overflow that couldn't fit in this huge War Memorial Gymnasium was in the dormitory areas where the delegates were living, so you could see them as you walked to and from your meetings. And then on our final worship service, the children had also been asked to draw a picture of themselves and to give their age and the country they were from. And they had done that, and they were asked to draw the picture with their arms outstretched like this. And all of those pictures were around the worship tent, forming a chain of children all the way around us as we closed the World Council of Churches assembly. And then we were each invited to take a picture when we left and to correspond with that child. Now, there were many fewer pictures than there were people in that tent, but still, I think about 3,500 people were able to get pictures of children. And to me, that is also a very hopeful sign, that the children are learning about and becoming participants in the ecumenical movement. Well, I've gone on much, much longer than I should have. But, I thank you all for letting me share what really was just a tremendous experience in my life.